Hello, hello everybody. It's good to see you. We are very glad to have today Louise Smith. She's currently on maternity leave. We were actually just discussing how family and of course that plays out with being a public servant. But what she's here to talk about is about her role as Deputy Director for Arts and Libraries at the Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport here in the UK. Today, Louise will share with us a very interesting and relevant public policy response to the COVID, which was basically the design and implementation of the UK's Culture Recovery Fund, but she will give us a broader context of the support of the arts and culture sector throughout these difficult and challenging times. Actually, this work earned her an Order of the British Empire, an OBE. We're very glad and congratulations on that, Louise, on this year's New Year's Honours list. So last but not least, she's a graduate from our school. So we're happy to have you here at your school, Louise. And please, the floor is yours. Over to you.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Vanessa. And lovely to see you all. And sorry that this couldn't be in person. I thought that I'd managed to escape COVID, but it finally caught up with me. And I can't quite escape those two lines yet. So I'm doing this from home. But thanks so much for having me. I've got a kind of slide at the beginning that just kind of sets out what I'm going to cover in today's session. And one of the things that I did when preparing for this was I spoke to the fellow people on my executive master's for public policy course and asked them kind of what made a good PIP session when we were doing them. And they said first that it's really important that there's some kind of context to the whole issue before you dive into the detail, particularly for people who aren't from the UK or the UK government sector. So I'm going to try and do a bit of that. I think second, trying to do that end-to-end process of the kind of why we were doing it, how we did it, what we did, and some reflections from me. Third, hopefully if the technology works, I've got a couple of little videos because I think it's nice to not just hear me speak, and obviously I'm really hoping that we've got some time for some good questions from you too. And then fourth, I was told to speak slowly, which is not a natural habit of mine, so do tell me if I'm speaking too quickly, but I'll do my best to try and slow down so you can digest what I'm saying. So I thought the first thing that would be useful to do is to start off with a bit of background about kind of the government in the UK's relationship with the cultural sector here pre-COVID, because I think that's quite important background. So I think the first thing to say is that DCMS has quite an arm's length relationship with the arts and cultural sector. That's quite deliberate. I think there's kind of lots of concern about kind of political interference with kind of arts and cultural sectors. And also, you know, just given the size of it, it doesn't make sense for a central government department to be kind of micromanaging thousands and thousands of organisations. So in terms of the kind of relationship, DCMS therefore, really our responsibility prior to the pandemic was to kind of provide strategic direction, funding, and hold to account a series of arm's length bodies in the UK. Now, those arm's length bodies were quite a mixture of beasts. So you had some of the big national cultural organisations like the National Gallery, the British Museum, British Library, who we provided direct funding to. But most of them were bigger organisations like the biggest being the Arts Council England, who don't provide arts and culture themselves, but who shape and provide funding to individual arts and cultural organisations. So they had like a national portfolio of about 900 organisations who they provided public funding to. But I think the cultural sector is obviously a lot wider than those that we had the kind of direct relationship with. So if you think about the kind of, I've got some symbols here to get us going, but you know, if you think about the kind of West End theatre, big commercial music organizations prior to the pandemic, they didn't have a relationship with government. We didn't provide them with funding. That just wasn't how the kind of that part of the economy worked. So there's no real neat line either around what we mean by the culture sector. And all of that, I hope, is kind of useful background for some of the challenges that we faced when the pandemic hit. So I wanted to then talk a little bit about kind of why we'd argue that the arts and cultural sector matters and why it's worth investing in it and why it needed protecting through COVID. So I'm not going to kind of read all these stats out, but there's obviously the kind of strong direct economic benefit that the sector has as a kind of a world leading sector in the UK. But then there's also really importantly that kind of strong indirect economic impact. So there's a stat there about the kind of supply chain effect. But to bring that to life a bit, if you think about putting on a big show, for instance, you need to invest not only in the show itself, but you invest in supporting and getting supply chain from lighting, sound. You might have carpentry to make sets. You might need investment in haulage to move those sets. There's costume makers, there's publicity, there's marketing. So there's that wider ecosystem. And then I think even broader than that is the effect that a successful cultural sector has on the wider economy. So again, if you're thinking of coming to the UK or you're traveling from another part of the UK to go to see a West End show, the likely chances are that you will go to a pre-theatre dinner, you might go for a drink afterwards, you might book a hotel, you might book some transport. So therefore, having a thriving cultural sector provides a wider economic benefit. We've got a bit there about kind of international standing. So obviously it's a big export for the UK. But I think also it's what attracts lots of people to visit the UK. So we know that that people who visit, I think it's about a third of people who visited the UK in 2017 went to one of our big museums and art galleries. And that's obviously expanded to lots of different other types of forms of culture. And I think it's no surprise that I had Shakespeare on one of the previous slides. You know, if you think about Shakespeare plays, they are probably translated and a big kind of brand for the UK across the world. But also when people visit, they tend to kind of want to go to Stratford-upon-Avon, to go to the Royal Shakespeare Company, go to the Globe. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling, a strong part of the economy. And then finally, there's lots of other wider benefits. So we know that having good arts and culture really improves people's sense of place and their pride in where they live, which obviously the government here at the moment has a big agenda around investing outside of London to level up areas. And it has been shown to work in arts and culture, that investment. So places like Hull and Coventry, which is our current kind of capital of culture, investment in those places has been shown to kind of improve those areas. And then similarly, pre-COVID, we were doing quite a lot of work around the benefits for kind of wider well-being. So actually using arts and culture as a preventative and treatment for kind of health issues has been shown to have positive impact and things like that. So that's kind of my pitch, I guess, for why it matters. And again, that's important for what we did next. So now moving on to kind of COVID and what the kind of impact looked like on the sector. So first bit of context is I was actually here in, I was not here because I wasn't home. I was at LSE in that week of the 9th to 13th of March 2020, doing my final week of the Executive Masters. So for the Executive Masters, there's an option where you can do what's called a capstone project, gets groups of civil servants together for a week to understand and try and solve a real life policy issue. So we were looking at investing in transport to try and level up transport in the UK. You know, certainly the kind of noise about COVID and the concern about it was kind of started to ramp up in that week. I remember there was talks about whether we could carry on doing that project in person, And I know that, you know, whilst I was doing that project here at LSE, there was a lot of kind of concern from my colleagues back in the office that this might be starting to be a thing. But at the time, we had no sense at all about the kind of size of the impact. So I'm just giving you a bit of a flavour here. I mean, then got back to work on the Monday, the 16th of March. And that was the first time that Boris Johnson here did one of his big televised addresses, which became kind of regular feature throughout the pandemic. I happened actually to be going to some friends for dinner that evening. And I remember just before leaving the office, that televised address happened, which included this line about avoiding pubs, clubs, and critically for me, theatres, to try and minimise the spread of COVID. It also talked about working from home. So I remember saying to my team, take your laptops home, thinking we might be at home working from home for a few days, and then we didn't actually go back for a few months, if not years. So that was quite interesting. But also went to my friends for dinner, but spent the entire time actually in a different room fielding calls from the sector as people started to realise what an impact this was going to have. And just looking at that at the time there wasn't a lockdown or a enforced closure, but just the effect that the Prime Minister saying, please don't go to a theatre, was going to have in terms of the demand that they were seeing, the impact of that. A few days later, we were talking about turning the tide on COVID in 12 weeks. And obviously that now, in hindsight, looks really laughable. But again, at the time, that felt kind of unimaginable and really kind of quite catastrophic, just to imagine 3 months of this kind of impact. And then on the 23rd of March, we had the first full lockdown. And then when I've got a stat there about the kind of impact on the arts and entertainment sector, where for lots of reasons, some of which are probably more obvious than others, it had a much bigger impact on the arts and cultural sector than many other parts of the economy in the UK. I think if you think about that, that's, I guess, as I say, probably not surprising. Arts and culture, it relies on having people in the same place, in the same room. It's has long lead-in times. You can't kind of shut it one day and expect to open a show or an exhibition the next day. It has very much kind of, it's very dependent, as I say, on international tourists, which we're obviously not going to be around. And it has very seasonal peaks. So, you know, very much relies on often the Christmas season and the summer holidays to kind of get through the rest of the rest of the year. And I think some things that people don't maybe realise as much about the arts and cultural sector is a lot of the sector is charitable. So they operate on kind of very small reserves. And also something about the operating model is these things are... these things, I think they kind of rely on the kind of more commercial shows or exhibitions in order to fund their more creative work. So you often don't get the kind of next big new show or the next big new artist without kind of having the profits from a kind of big commercial area. So I think that's kind of some of the background on that. I think the other thing just to note is that in the UK, there was a big focus from the Treasury at the time on big pan economic measures to start supporting the economy. So we had our kind of job retention scheme, furlough scheme, supporting people who couldn't work, and business rates relief and things like that. And that was very deliberate to have some kind of fast, hard-hitting measures that didn't require you to kind of make judgments about certain sectors against others. And so to ask for something specific for the arts and cultural sector at that point was quite a difficult ask, because there was already that kind of strong set of pan economic measures that, that Treasury had put in place. So let me just move on. So then just wanted to talk a little bit about the kind of policy and delivery challenges that we faced. So I think obviously the first one was pace. So all of the kind of evidence that we were seeing was that the cliff edge of quite you know, big, well-known cultural organizations, but also the kind of wider ecosystem failing was going to happen fast, in a matter of months. And that was a really, you know, huge problem in terms of scale. And one of the things that we, you know, came back to in our arguments for why we needed to do something here was that a lot of these things aren't, it's different to say a shop or a restaurant, where if one closes, another one will probably in due course open in its place. With cultural organisations, they're often things that are irreplaceable. And so that's the kind of, if we were going to see the failure of some really historic things, it's not easy to then kind of replicate those in the future. And then obviously it's the timing of then trying to deliver something of this scale. It was like the Capstone project suddenly in real life, and with a huge kind of burden, which I think is why kind of some of the criticisms of how people were working at that time, the civil services, it's been quite challenging at the moment, because knowing how kind of hard people were working, certainly where I was at the time. Then, as I say, another challenge was the existing setup we had. So, as I said at the beginning, we didn't have a very direct relationship with the arts and cultural sector historically, for deliberate reasons. But that meant that when we were starting to try and think, what do we need to do, we didn't have the data and evidence necessarily of impact that we needed. And suddenly everyone was looking to DCMS for an answer, having, you know, never really looked to us for an answer before. There's then something about stakeholders. So the arts and cultural sector is full of very important, very high profile, and people who, because they are famous film stars or whatever it is, have a kind of a platform. And so the public pressure on us to do something was really, really strong. But equally, it's a vast ecosystem. So what might have kept the commercial theatre sector happy wasn't going to keep your community arts group in Huddersfield happy. So there was always that trade-off too. And I'm just going to now stop talking for 2 seconds if I can. And I just wanted to show you a video as a way to kind of illustrate this a bit, because for people who might who are from the UK will know that the Andrew Marr Show is the kind of big political show that is on the BBC on a Sunday morning. And this was the kind of an example of Sam Mendes, who people don't know is the film director for Bond films and other things, doing some direct lobbying of government on TV. So I just wanted to quickly show that if this works.
The winning film director, probably best known for his Bond films and 1917. But before that, he was winning awards for his theatre productions in London's West End. As theatres great and small face bankruptcy following the shutdown, he's not only worried, but he has an idea. I spoke to him this morning and asked him how serious the situation for the live performing arts and the people who work in them really is.
Well, sadly, I'm afraid it's very serious indeed. You know, I think we've already seen dreadful warnings across the country, local theatres closing in Southampton, in Southport, in Leicester. We've seen whole communities now beginning to be deprived of the possibility of live performance for the future. You know, and I think it's very important that one stresses this is not a theatre just closing down until it can reopen again. These are theatres going into receivership that are going to reopen as nightclubs or just be torn down or as bingo halls. And I think that's the degree of seriousness, and that's the situation we find ourselves in at the moment.
So for people who don't go to the theatre regularly at the moment and are wondering, why should I care, but are kind of patriotic and enthused about Britain, as it were, why should they care?
In 2018, the cultural sector brought in £32.4 billion to the UK. You know, so it is a going concern. It's a huge, massive economic growth engine. And so we've come up with this plan, which we feel represents the theatre as a whole and enables the government to be a participation in success. so that they find a way to get some of the money back, so that the taxpayer doesn't feel they're simply throwing money down into a black hole.
So how does
but at the same time, the whole theatre community can benefit.
I was just going to ask you how this actually works, because on the one hand, you've got highly profitable theatres, and on the other hand, less profitable theatres, some of them facing imminent bankruptcy now. Do they all come together in one new organisation the government then funds and gets money back from in due course?
You know, it could be summed up in three simple tranches, in a sense. The first is we have to continue the job retention schemes. Live performance, to state the obvious, can only happen once a night. And when the capacity is limited to 20%, it becomes absolutely impossible. So what we have to do is keep the theatres open, keep the self-employed with some way of remaining alive over the next 6 to 9 months, however long it is. And that means it's important for the job retention scheme to keep going. Then there has been an enormously successful tax relief scheme for the theatre. And we're asking for that is extended from 20% to 50% for a year or more, so that, again, it has a chance to earn back the money once it opens. And most important, I suppose, is this scheme that has been come up with called the cultural, I think it's called the Cultural Investment Participation Scheme. It's a bit of a mouthful. But the reality is that is offering the government a chance to be an angel in production, to be an investor in productions, so that in success, they make the money back that they have given to support the community in the short term.
Now, you are a connected man, if I can put it that way. And you've said this is the biggest threat to the UK's cultural life since the Second World War. So what kind of response are you getting from ministers?
Well, it's been positive so far. I mean, the article that I wrote in the Financial Times only came out 2 days ago. And I have to say there has been a swift response, positive. There is a feeling that people want to find a way through this. The theatre community obviously is full of very articulate and brilliant individuals who are all working on it as hard as they possibly can. And I do feel there is a way through here. I feel very positive about it. I think one has to stay positive. I think it's very easy to write and say, you know, the death to announce the death knell of the theatre. And really, I think one needs to find practical solutions. And I believe there is a way here. And I feel that there has been a sense that that has been listened to, and that over the next couple of weeks, I hope these things might begin to have some purchase.
So I just wanted to show you that as a kind of example of the kind of external pressure. And I think it's kind of hard now in hindsight to really feel what that feels like. But I think in lots of cases of public policy, one of the pressures that you have is where there's a lot of kind of vocal noise externally with lots of ideas and trying to cut through kind of both obviously ministers' desire to react where they think those are kind of fair criticisms, but equally making sure that the answer is still a good public policy one. So as I say, sorry, just so now on, I've done the first three. The final two big challenges for us was one was novelty. I mean, everything about coronavirus is obviously novel, but we had some specific niche things that I think are actually quite important to consider too. So one was, we had basically a brand new ministerial team at the time. We had a new cultural secretary and arts minister who had started in mid-February. That was a kind of, you know, challenge of working with them to make sure that what they wanted was being delivered whilst them still being kind of quite new to the background. Obviously a new way of working for us all ourselves. You know, we were all at home. Couldn't just kind of pop round to someone's desk and novel them a little bit. They had to actually answer your telephone calls or join your Zoom meetings. And then, you know, more seriously, it's an entirely new relationship between government and society and economy. As I say, most of the arts and cultural sector were quite happy to be left alone by government and didn't want to be interfered with for a long time, but all of a sudden they were looking to us. And then I think there's something then about the uncertainty of the path of the virus. We're trying to design a public policy response here, but none of us, and certainly, you know, don't now, but didn't then either, didn't really know what the path of the virus was going to be. And how do you design something that responds to the fact that it turns out to be something that lasts for years rather than the kind of weeks or months that were first envisaged? And also, how do you cater for not entirely knowing how the sector and the wider public themselves will respond? So we didn't know at the time how much of the cultural sector would maybe diversify their offer, how much would kind of close down completely. As I say, a lot of the organisations are charitable organisations. What would their trustees be willing to do? And then in terms of the wider public response, you know, some of this is still evolving, but we didn't know whether anything would ever be the same again in terms of, would people really want to come back to arts and cultural organisations? Do people want to sit in an auditorium together in the same way as they would have been happy to do previously? Were international tourists going to return even when they were able to do so? So these are all things that we were trying to respond to. So then I think it's useful to say a bit about kind of how we decided to what we wanted to do. So as I said at the beginning, because of our kind of arm's length relationship with the sector, we didn't have the data, the perfect data set that you would love if you're a public policymaker thinking, okay, what is it like, what really is this impact and what can we really do to make a difference? So we did a number of things. We did really widespread surveys through our arm's length bodies and sector bodies to try and get more of that understanding of impact. Although again, I think it's important to say with things like this, you know, obviously we had to take a lot of that with a pinch of salt. You know, there's obviously a lot of bias. There was quite a lot of pessimism. So kind of trying to understand some of that, but cut through it too. And we did, we were really lucky that in confidence, some organizations really opened up their books to us to show us, you know, really the state of their finances, what their reserves look like, how long they would be able to be a going concern. But again, kind of, I think one of the things I wanted to say was, you know, you have to be really careful with that, like the extrapolation of that. Looking at the kind of books of a big commercial organisation doesn't extrapolate into what the impact looks like for a really wide sector. I think the next thing that we tried to do was obviously think about the objective. So what was it that our ministers hoped to achieve by any intervention, and how did that balance up against what maybe some of the boundaries and priorities were for the Treasury in number 10. So there, I think, you know, obviously for our ministers, they wanted something big, they wanted something ambitious, they wanted something that from their perspective both protected the kind of crown jewels, the big totemic things in the UK's arts and cultural sector, but also they didn't want to lose those smaller but really important arts organisations all around the country. Unsurprisingly, I think from the Treasury's perspective, they're not going to be prepared to write a big blank cheque. So there was quite a lot there about they understood the case that, you know, probably Sam Mendes made more compellingly than me, but, you know, about kind of the importance and the irreplaceability of the arts and cultural sector in the UK. But they really wanted to therefore focus any response on that failure. So avoiding that failure, not being seen to use taxpayers' money to subsidise kind of lots and lots of discretionary activity. And they were also really concerned that obviously they didn't want it to overlap with their pan-economic schemes, and were concerned about kind of governance and how we were going to make sure everything was robust. As Sam Mendes said, which is nice, we did engage with loads of stakeholders, hundreds over a few very intense weeks. And then again, I think, you know, that's a really positive thing to do. It's quite hard then, though you're absolutely bombarded with everyone's wish list. So trying to cut through what's an actual sensible proposition that fits with your objectives, as well as knowing once your response is starting to shape up, knowing who would respond to it well and who might need a bit of extra management because it wasn't going to. The fourth way we decided what we were going to do was to kind of look internationally. So what were other countries doing? So at the time, Olaf Scholz, as the kind of finance minister in Germany, announced, before we announced anything, a big kind of £2 billion cultural euro support program there. So we're looking at things like that and looking at other countries. So again, they all operate quite differently, but you know, in New York, there was investment to bring back shows in the West End. I think Harry Potter was the first show to get going back in Melbourne. So, you know, there's lots of kind of looking internationally too. And then the final thing, which is always important not to forget, because it's actually the at the end of the day is the thing that's going to make it a success or not, is what could we actually deliver in time? So given this kind of fast approaching cliff edge, how could we do this big ambitious scheme, but actually get the money to where it needs to be fast? And how could we make sure that despite it being fast, that didn't mean that we were by kind of being loose and fancy free with taxpayers' money? So the solution. So I love this page just because, you know, I think I might print this out and stick it on my bedroom wall, I don't know. So this is this was the 6th of July 2020, and I think kind of a bit of a career highlight for me in that every newspaper in the UK, from every kind of, you know, you can see there from the kind of Daily Express through to the Financial Times, had something on its front pages about the Cultural Recovery Fund that we announced. So it was a really big day for all of us when we finally kind of got all the agreements we needed within government and managed to announce that we were going to run this fund. So take a breath, have the headlines, what was it actually going to do? So so the Cultural Recovery Fund actually, you know, it was a huge amount of money. By far the biggest investment that has ever kind of been made by this government, not this government, any government in the UK in culture, given the kind of scenario we were facing. It was eventually about £2 billion and supported kind of over 5,000 organisations. And the initial fund, just to quickly kind of explain some of the elements, although I don't want to go into too much detail, but there was the vast majority of the money was basically some big grants and repayable finance for organisations, so culturally significant organisations who are at risk of financial failure across the UK. I think it's worth just pausing on that, because one of the things that we had to work up was for lots of the smaller organisations, they needed grants, so kind of immediate cash injections just to survive. And so that's what most of the money was going to be. But there was rightly a feeling that this was taxpayers' money. So where organisations were big enough, commercial enough to be able to repay that money over time, they should be taking loans rather than grants. So there was two elements to that. As I say, there's some national cultural institutions, some of those ones I mentioned at the beginning, like the National Gallery and the British Museum, who have a direct relationship with DCMS. So there was some money for them. £100 million of capital investment again. So lots of these, you know, these historic, big historic buildings or with big collections had lots of money saved aside to maintain and make sure that their these buildings weren't going to kind of fall over and that they would. But a lot of that money had to be diverted to just keeping these organisations alive. So we made sure there was some money to invest in capital building works where that had kind of stopped because of COVID. And then again, for people who are in the UK context, this will be kind of familiar to them, but maybe not for other people. But with any kind of funding that happens that goes to English organisations, there's always kind of the equivalent funding through what's called the Barnett formula, to which goes to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland to also invest in supporting their cultural organisations. So what the fund did was, as I said, quite a simple test of focusing on those organisations that were culturally significant, be that internationally, nationally or locally, and who had a genuine risk of failing financially if they didn't get investment. That kind of simplicity was really important because, as I said, the getting money out the door quickly was critical. And so we delivered through our arm's length bodies as they had those existing funding mechanisms. But given kind of some of the worries about could we govern such a big amount of money successfully, we also established a board to kind of oversee particularly some of the bigger repayable finance elements that were going to organisations, and to look at the balance of funding overall. And then I think it's also important then just to touch on what the fund didn't do. So it didn't support everyone, which was particularly controversial to two groups of people. So one was the commercial theatre sector, because as I say, one of the tests that we agreed with the Treasury was that organisations had to be at risk of financial failure. And those many of those organisations couldn't demonstrate that that was going to happen, and that they didn't have other sources of funding that could keep them going at that point. But obviously that was really controversial given their kind of profile and importance in the culture sector. And then the other one was we didn't have anything to support freelancers directly, which there was a big campaign about. Again, the argument there being we had the self-employment income support scheme, but also by supporting the kind of cultural organisations themselves to survive, we ultimately there would be kind of work coming back because they still existed. So then I think this is my kind of final slide, which I think is probably hopefully just about right in terms of how long I've been speaking. I thought it was just worth me then sharing my reflections from this whole experience in terms of what I took away from it for kind of from a kind of wider public policy perspective, and what I might think about doing differently in the future. So I think the first of these is kind of being really clear what problem it is you're trying to solve. So especially with something as broad as basically there's a huge sector, can you make sure that they survive, please? There are so many competing voices and ideas within government and externally, kind of keeping coming back to that, what is it that we are actually going to achieve here? And critically being quite explicit about what it is that you're not going to be able to do with your solution is really important. And I think I'd confess that that objective changed at certain points, and that sometimes it was easy to lose sight of it, but I think kind of always coming back to that, I think, is really important. The second thing I wanted to say a little bit about was about trade-offs, which I think basically, if it's a complex problem, trade-offs are basically inevitable, but again, being explicit on them is really important. And I think the biggest example I probably have here is this idea that we needed to fund things at pace. But obviously, and there's been quite a lot of attention about this now kind of in hindsight, is one thing getting the money out the door quickly, but it is taxpayers' money, and how do you make sure that it's therefore not being abused and not going to the wrong places? And so I think we did do things to mitigate against that. We did try and make the scheme as simple as possible. We did kind of do things like only allow organisations to benefit if they had a certain number of years accounts. And we did have kind of governance in place to look at, to scrutinise kind of bigger applications and to make sure we were looking out for things like fraud. But I think it's still important to recognise that, firstly, that meant that some people weren't supported who perhaps were, you know, very good, you know, causes, but they didn't meet our criteria, so they weren't supported. And second, that you need to think about risk appetite, and the risk appetite had to be quite high here, given the cliff edge, but you have to kind of be explicit about the consequences of that, particularly being explicit as a civil servant to politicians, because it's important that people kind of understand some of the trade-offs that are going to have to be made. So I think I'll definitely take away that as a future thing. Except that you will always have critics. Again, I think if you're working on a big controversial issue, this is going to happen, but kind of understanding where they matter. And I talked a bit about kind of both the commercial theatre and the campaigns we had about why weren't we supporting directly freelancers. And I, you know, I hope that the kind of justification I just gave, it, you know, is a justification that I would still stand by. But I think it is important to kind of understand you have a rationale to respond to those critics. And if you don't, that probably is then something to maybe pause on. And then I also wanted to just say, like I said, we looked at international comparisons, but I think it's also important to look at those in context and not be too wedded to them. So I think we got a bit caught up at some points about kind of, oh, this country's announced a big fund, we must do the same, or this country's opening up, so we must do the same. And actually, there were very different contexts. So actually going back to the German example, or looking at lots of other European countries, their cultural sectors are largely much more publicly funded than the UK's is in general. And therefore, the kind of both the response might be different, and that's fine. And similarly, at the time when we were looking at, oh, Melbourne's opening up and putting on Harry Potter, yes, but bear in mind at the time the COVID levels in those two countries were very, very different. And so what may have been the right thing to be doing in Australia wasn't necessarily the right thing to be doing in the UK. And then I thought I'd just finish by saying, I think, as good public policy makers, I think you always should reflect on what you would do differently. But I thought I'd share this nice little video to show some people who were really grateful for what was achieved and that made me happy that I think we had done a good thing. Let me just see if I can play this short video, my little promo.
The funding we've received will go towards helping to protect the 90 jobs across our organisation.
This will allow us to continue to operate through the winter and to do some projects that will help drive visitors to this iconic heritage site.
Allows us to bring back our freelance staff contractors to start planning one of the UK's biggest LGBTQ pride events.
This will make a massive difference to our organisation, to culture in the region, and to the artists whose work we can now present back on these stages again.
Your support is going to make such a difference for us here, allowing us to keep our doors open for our young people and for our hyper-local community.
It's a lifeline for the museum. We can't wait to work in partnership with our audiences again to make sure we're delivering for everyone.
We will use every single penny to look after and invest in the ecosystem that we serve. Our artists, our freelance workforce, our institution, our work with our community.
This will go a long way to sustaining Yorkshire Sculpture Park's future and enabling us to continue to bring the best of world-class art and sculpture to Yorkshire and to the UK.
So we can plan and prepare our theatre, our studio events and much, much more as we go into next year.
So there's my nice little happy video to finish with, and hopefully there's some inspiration there of some good arts and cultural venues around the UK that you might like to go and visit to support them coming out the other side of the pandemic. And that was all I was going to say, but obviously happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Louise. I think this was a fascinating, clear, tangible case of public policy making. The way you envisaged it under a crisis, under uncertainty, and all of what it takes to create a public policy in this case, in a crisis context. But here with us is our dean, Andres Velasco. And of course, I will give him the word in case he wants to make a comment or ask questions about what you just presented. Thank you, Luis. And please, Dean Velasco.
Good evening, everyone. Luis, thank you so much for that inspiring presentation. Thank you all, the rest of you, for joining us tonight. That was really something. I want to say that, as you know, the School of Public Policy trains people from around the world to take up responsibilities and to do important things at very, very difficult times. And it's hard to imagine a more difficult time than the time the world faced a year ago or 2 years ago. And And you were at the helm of a pretty amazing initiative, which did a lot of good. So from the bottom of my heart, congratulations and thank you. I should also say congrats, belated congrats on your OBE. That is very, very well done. And to the best of my knowledge, you're the first School of Public Policy graduate to be so honored. And that is really very admirable. On a personal note, I should say that I learned English from a man who had received an OBE many, many, many years ago. So he taught me what it means and how important it is. So kudos to you, Louise. I'm going to allow myself one question, if I may. And it has to do with, forgive the jargon, the sort of the microeconomics of assignment. Because when you do these programs, you know, I was a finance minister of Chile during the world financial crisis, and we did programs like this, not for the arts, but for, you know, you run the risk that that you will make some people happy and you will make a lot of people upset because for some reason they didn't get what they expected or as much as they expected. Or, you know, you described some situations like that. Freelancers were not covered. Commercial theaters were not covered. But I also imagine that, you know, within the sectors that were covered, you know, you had to make a choice. Institution A gets X pounds, institution B gets Y pounds. And the trade-offs there are inevitably difficult. I'm wondering, and you sort of hinted at this, but you didn't go into the weeds. Did you have hard and fast rules so that institutions got an amount proportional on something? Was it done on a case-by-case basis? And if so, how did you deal with upset people who thought they did not get their fair share? I mean, it's a fascinating issue, but also I imagine a very, very tricky issue. And I'm curious to know more how you faced it. But again, let me just say, first of all, thank you for this wonderful presentation and congratulations.
Thank you. So I think that was definitely a problem that we faced. I think there's probably a couple of things that we did to try and minimize but not be able to eliminate that problem. So I think having a really I think relatively simple but really quite clear set of criteria was did work quite well, because it meant that, because we had this idea that you had to be at risk of financial failure and be able to show that with your books and show how much, right down to the kind of how many weeks of reserves you had and therefore how much did you need to be able to survive till X point. And we gave quite a lot of kind of working assumptions about the kind of scenario to plan against and things like that. That meant that it was quite hard to argue. You people apply for an amount and generally they were given it as long as they could prove that they had applied for an amount that met those criteria. So I think that was quite important. I think the other thing, though, that I probably didn't talk enough about was using the kind of existing apparatus that we had through our arm's length bodies to stop it being kind of DCMS as a small central government team making all of those decisions. So we used things like the Arts Council England or the British Film Institute or the National Lottery Heritage Fund and their expertise there to be doing those assessments for those their different parts of the sector and making those judgments, which I think helped at least kind of make it more deliverable, but also kind of make it kind of clear that there was that kind of expertise that was looking at those things. But inevitably, you're right, there were people who didn't meet those criteria and felt aggrieved that they hadn't received the support they wanted.
Thank you, Louise. And can I ask you to stop sharing the screen so we can see each other better?
Yeah.
I think we cannot do it yet. Thank you so much. And just before I pass on the word to Paul and to Adita who have questions, I have a couple of questions. One is to look at the past, and the other is more to look at into the future. Wasn't there anything in place prior to this crisis? So what about crisis prevention? What about crisis scenarios in the department? Were there any? Was there anything that you can build up on and perhaps scale that you took advantage of? So that's one question. And the other, the department is called Digital Culture, Media and Sport. What about thinking, I think that this should have ignited more coordination or more projects, at least in the future, between digital and cultural, no? Because that's also a sort of way that comes to my mind in terms of thinking about future crises and thinking about preparedness to deal with shocks that were either expected or unexpected. But at the end, we always have to be prepared for these kind of circumstances, regardless of the scale, no? So that's my question. And perhaps if you can have a comment that I think would be very useful for the students in terms of how useful it is to have governance, to have transparency, and to have accountability in these kind of projects and in these kind of special funds. Because I always tell them in my class that this will be something that will chase them forever, no? So the best, they sort of prepare for that and you know, do all the legal aspects of that for the future. It's best for everyone. So just some comments there, and I'll pass on the word afterwards to Paul and Adita.
Yeah, sure. So I think in terms of the kind of, did we have the crisis response in place? So I think there has certainly been work, I guess, you know, the financial crisis prior to this had meant that there had been previous work looking at kind of organisations that had faced kind of failure for a different reason back at that point. I think it's fair to say that was slightly different, because I think obviously if there had been really, really significant organisations at that point that had faced failure, there would have been a kind of bespoke intervention. But somehow this, I don't think there had been anything, or I don't think we'd envisaged anything that would be quite as widespread in terms of its impact. And so although there was, there's always kind of that kind of, you know, what we'd call the civil contingencies preparation, I think this almost was like a kind of second order economic issue that we hadn't quite, we definitely certainly hadn't got the kind of level of preparation in place. So we might have always thought about kind of terrorism is another good example. We have plans in place to think about what we might do if there's a terrorist incident in London and that closed theatres, and how we handle that from a practical perspective. But I think that what this showed was that we'd done less on like thinking about kind of a widespread economic impact like this. I think on digital, that's a really good point. And I think at one point I said something about we weren't quite sure how the cultural sector might evolve and kind of diversify its offer. And one thing, the sector is still clear that a purely digital model isn't one that is kind of economically viable. But I think what we did learn was that there are ways to bring arts and culture to people that don't necessarily need a physical presence. And I think more is being done now to think about kind of how that can be built upon to be more kind of creative, which is the sector is creative, so it should build on that. But also, are there ways to actually make that more of an economically viable model? And then third, on governance and transparency. So yeah, I think that was really important. And I think that is why we established this cultural recovery board, particularly, was to give that kind of extra level of scrutiny. So it wasn't just all devolved to arm's length bodies. There was this kind of central oversight, and we could have kind of the really clear lines of accountability. So for the kind of smaller amounts of funding that was kind of devolved to the arms length bodies to make those assessments, as I was just saying to Andres, about kind of who should receive what funding and things like that. But very clearly they were accountable for those decisions back to the department. And then for those bigger awards, you know, the kind of multi-million pound awards to some of the bigger organisations, those are scrutinised much more centrally by this board, so that the accountability was much kind of closer to DCMS. But I think, you know, it's really important. We've already had the Public Accounts Committee and the National Audit Office looking at the programme, and inevitably that's kind of really important given the amount of money that was involved.
Thank you, Louise. Now, Paul, please.
Hi. Well, first of all, thank you so much for your presentation and your insight. I'm curious as to how you manage the issues around the time frame of policies. I suppose the plans would have to look very different depending on how long you expected venues to be closed and so on. And I also wonder the uncertainty around it must have made it a great challenge. So I'm very curious to hear about that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That probably was one of the biggest challenges. And one thing that actually we did, and I, you know, in hindsight, you're trying to remember how much this was a deliberate design, but it's something that I would definitely, if I was facing something like this in the future, would definitely do it again, was we did two things. So one was that when we gave out the kind of first set of criteria for the funding and the first kind of application round, we set out a series of assumptions that we asked people to plan against about how we thought things would reopen in the summer at that point, and to kind of model on that effect. But we were really clear that we would have to change the amounts that they were receiving if those assumptions changed, which gave us some flexibility. So I think that's really important to kind of have some assumptions, because if you don't have any assumptions, no one has anything to plan against, but make sure that there's some flexibility in those assumptions. And then the second thing that I think we did, which, as I say, I think was really quite important in hindsight, was we did tranche the money. So we, although we had this big amount, we were very careful to kind of hold back different bits and had several, you know, I'm on maternity leave at the moment, but I imagine that, you know, they've got to kind of write at least round five, I don't know, but kind of holding some of that money back so we could respond differently. And that proved to be particularly important actually at the end of 2020. So we were really optimistic about getting kind of theatres in particular reopened for December 2020, which was their kind of peak season, the kind of pantomime Christmas show period. And then obviously that was when we had kind of the really, really severe second wave. And so actually having some of that flexibility at that point to be able to respond was really important. Having not spent all the money was a good lesson in hindsight. So those are probably the two things, but you're right, it was incredibly difficult. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want to say at all that we got those assumptions right, because none of us, I don't think any of us in March 2020 had any idea that it would still kind of be going on at this point.
Thank you so much, Luis. Now, Adita, please.
Sure, camera's off. Thank you so much. As a voracious devourer of culture in this city, I think, and thank you personally for that work. I appreciate it. And I also think this is not a topic that maybe gets as much airtime in these institutions generally. So I'm really glad to be able to hear from you, someone who's experienced directly in this sector. But I had a couple of questions. One was a bit more specific to what you've done over the last couple of years, and another is a bit more broad. So on the first one, I was wondering, you know, if you mentioned a little bit about sort of this, how arts can fit into the wider leveling up program of sort of the economic development of places outside the highest concentration, you know, London and Manchester, big cities. But I was wondering, did you get any reaction over the course of this process of people saying that this is essentially bailing out the big cities, you know, where a lot of these institutions are concentrated, as well as the people who work in the space. And of course, not all of whom are, most of whom are privileged to begin with. And so, you know, how did you deal with that if it did come up, and sort of how did you manage the external facing side of this? Because of course it is an incredibly important problem, one that affected a lot of people, not only in the big cities. And the second question is a little bit higher level. And I wanted to ask you your personal opinion on where you think the government's role should be in the arts more broadly going, you know, in the future. And that could, you know, it could be more funding, like you brought the example of Germany, or, you know, whether it's ecosystem support or guidance. I know that DCM has a white paper from a few years ago on culture. It talked about crowdfunding, for example, which I think is interesting, but is sort of beside the role of a central government institution. And so just wanted to hear your thoughts at a very high level on where you think in the future we should be aiming in terms of the relationship between government and the cultural sphere in general. Thanks again.
Great. Yeah, really, really interesting question. So I think, we did certainly, there was certainly concern that basically this cultural recovery fund was going to kind of lead to funding for what, you know, I kind of called the crown jewels at the expense of kind of things that were kind of important locally. I think that there was two things that we did to try and counter that. So one was, I said that like one of the main criteria is you have to be culturally significant, but what was really important about that definition was we talked about that from us, you know, you could be culturally significant because you could be the Tower of London and like one of the top visitors attractions by, you know, international tourists, but you could equally be culturally significant because I'm trying to think of a good example here. You know, there's a fantastic Chester Story House, there's a fantastic, you know, arts and library venue up there, where actually that was like, you know, would be like the cultural significant thing in that place. And therefore that should also kind of, in terms of the criteria, should be equally weighted against. And then I think the other thing that we did was we had a set of balancing criteria that we would look at where the kind of fund was oversubscribed, which included making sure that we were not skewing overly towards London in particular, although that was reflective of the balance as it existed rather than trying to change the balance. And so I think that was quite an important thing. I think ultimately actually quite a lot of funding did get outside of London, and we were quite pleased actually with not too much kind of actual effort. I think we thought we'd have to do maybe more skewing of it than we did. Actually, a lot of the funding did go to places outside of London. I think we were lucky that actually we managed to fund, I think, all kind of organisations that met that culturally significant criteria. So that helped with that. And then I think on your second question, kind of about government role in the arts more broadly. So I think the whole experience was probably that we went too far into, but I think, you know, right for the response, but I think we went too far into government like worrying and having a direct relationship with too much of the sector. And I think it does need to be reset a bit because I think it's important that I think in terms of actually probably not just funding, but I think more where governments have an agenda where arts and culture can be useful. I think this would certainly be my thinking when I kind of return to the job after maternity leave. There's lots of things at the moment, you know, levelling up is the obvious one, but there's lots of other areas, whether it's kind of the agenda on education or the agenda on health or criminal justice or whatever it is, where actually arts and culture, investment in arts and culture will actually help with wider government objectives. And so I think it's less about should government give more funding to the arts or should it be more directly involved in the arts. I think it's more where can investment in the arts also help not just arts and culture for itself, but some of those wider objectives. So I think that's probably how I see it, rather than there needs to be more funding, or, you know, I don't think there should just be more funding for the sake of more funding. I think there should be more funding for certain objectives, if that makes sense.
Please, Egerton.
Hello, Louise. Pleased to meet you. Thank you for the amazing presentation. I can relate a bit because I used to work in the Brazilian Ministry of Culture. So I can see a lot of similar things and a lot of different things. my question is, back in Brazil, at least, there is a very big problem of how to measure the impact of cultural policies, because, well, culture is something very hard to measure, right? I'm curious to know how it's possibly done here in the UK to evaluate if our policy is working or not. And in respect to the specific policy of the COVID relief fund, and if something was thought on how to evaluate what would happen after. And thank you.
Great. Lovely to meet a fellow cultural person. I think that's really, yeah, it's really, really difficult. But I think really, really important that we do more on it. So I think we have in recent years, but actually we're doing this in the Cultural Recovery Fund too, have made sure that we are actually investing a significant portion of any government, you know, so if a government announces a scheme like this, or prior to the pandemic, we'd announced another big cultural investment fund to invest in culture in places. We always now make sure that there's a significant portion of the funding held back for evaluation, and that evaluation is planned at the beginning of the program, rather than at the end, retrospectively trying to work out if it worked or not, which this course taught me would never work. I think the other thing that is actually quite interesting in the UK, if anyone wants to read more about it, is the government's actually investing quite a lot of time and money at the moment into something called cultural heritage capital. And effectively, in the UK, any kind of bid to the Treasury for funding has to be looked at through the Green Book requirements, and like looking at the kind of costs and benefits and, you know, all the other things that you need to look at. And as you say, that is very... The measures of that very much are skewed towards things that have much more kind of concrete traditional economic value, I guess. And the government here did invest quite a lot of work over quite a long time looking at, I can't remember if this is the right term, but effectively green capital. So again, looking at the investment in, you know, if you invest in protecting the environment, actually what's the benefit of that, and how can that be weighed up in a similar way to weighing up the kind of traditional economic benefits. And so it will take years to get this right, but one of the things that we're actually looking at the moment is there a way to look at assessing kind of the impact of investment in culture, heritage and capital that can have the same sway as the kind of traditional economic measures. That's a really, really interesting piece of work. And I don't know, if I'm still in the culture space in 10 years time, I hope that can be something that I can add to my CV, that we've managed to crack that one, because it would be great if we could.
Thank you. Yes, I think we still have a lot to do in this field. Just out of curiosity, this topic, it was what got me into LSC, because I wrote an essay about this in my application, how to measure cultural policies in Brazil. And okay, it's lovely to hear from you.
I'd love to read it. I'd love to read it.
Thank you so much.
Can I ask? I don't see any other hands up, so maybe I'll ask a question. How much pushback was there? I'm thinking back to my day in the Ministry of Finance. You know, every time one proposes money for culture, at least in my experience, there is pushback from people who say, well, people in the world of culture, or they're all middle class or above. You know, we really have people in need. They're, you know, kids who need better nutrition and people who need better housing. And, you know, these are all posh people after all. How come you're giving them money? Did you get some of that? And if so, how did you deal with it?
Yeah, so I think there certainly is, I think, always an element of that. And I think this is probably where almost the opposite to my previous answer is true, which is actually, I think what we were trying to argue in the outset here was this isn't about protecting these art forms just for the sake of those middle class, people who can afford to go and see the opera. There's economics to this, and actually we know that as an export, as a attractor to international tourists, etc., etc., if we don't have I don't know why I've got obsessed with the Tower of London today, but we don't have the Tower of London, that won't happen. So there's that element to it, but you know, and the employment and the, and as I say, the kind of transformation of places. But I think also another thing, so I've talked a bit, I've kind of gone into a bit more of the detail in terms of things like our criteria and balancing and things like that. Another of the things was we did have we had conditions of this funding, and we use those conditions to try and, continue to push the sector in the right way. So, you know, there was conditions about opening up more to young people and things like this to make sure that the money wasn't just going to back to middle class pockets.
Right. On that note, I'm going to say goodbye because I have to join another call. But Louise, again, thank you very, very much. Wonderful work, great remarks today. Hope to see you on campus sooner rather than later.
Yeah, lovely to see you.
Bye. Bye everyone, sorry to leave, bye.
I guess we're actually coming to an end, but before we do that, I would like to ask one final question. Luis, if you answered Adita on a more structural view on the way you see, you know, the investment in culture for the future, but what lessons learned you have from the actions you took during the crisis? If you would be in charge when you go back to the ministry of putting in place the next firewall scheme or readiness for emergency scheme for the future, what would you think of? Like how does the institution need to strengthen better to face the next crisis? And in terms of public policy design, what would be your three takes on what the strategic actions to do that strengthening would be?
Yeah, so that's really, it's hard, but a good question. So I think there's something about looking at the resilience of the sector itself. So Adita was talking about the previous culture white paper where we talked about kind of crowdfunding and things like that. I do think that one of the benefits of, or one of the advantages of the UK sector is that we have pushed it to be more commercial and less reliant on public funding. But that actually also then caused problems when that commercial income goes away. And I don't think that necessarily means that the balance of public funding needs to change, but I do think that it means that it is worth some thinking about the different income streams, whether it's philanthropy or other things that the sector is more resilient. It has more different income streams so that it's more resilient and less reliant on, say, public funding, should such a crisis kind of occur again. So I think there's something about that. I think the other thing that I talked a bit about kind of because of this arm's length nature, we didn't really have the data that we needed. And I think it is important, as I said, that we don't kind of therefore kind of just become no longer arm's length and try and change a relationship too much, but I think it has made me think there's probably a base level of data and understanding that it's important the department has so that it could react with kind of more confidence more quickly if something like this happened again. So I think there's data, I think there's resilience of the sector. And then I think that this scheme worked, as I say, because of needing to be delivered really fast and it being therefore quite simple. But I think if you were doing it again with this hindsight, I think that it would be worth thinking about kind of more creative initiatives, like what more could we get back from the sector in return for giving funding? You know, this is ultimately is taxpayers' money. And I think what we would argue is that we've now saved these institutions so they will give back to the country. But being more creative perhaps about what you were getting in return, I think would be quite interesting.
Thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. Thanks for your time. Even though you're sick, you were here and you didn't cancel the event, which we're grateful for. And we hope we can still be in touch with you in the coming months to see how that evolves. And of course, many of our students would like to be in touch with you as well as Egerton himself just mentioned. So thank you, Luis. And thank you everybody for being present. See you in the next Policy in Practice seminar.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.